the first car that you would rather have owned, if you see what I mean. So what was your first car? What was the first car that you really wanted?
A Red Rover Metro. It cost me £400, bought from a bloke on the outskirts of Leeds. And I'll be honest, I wouldn't have changed it for the world, Don. It had a choke. Do you remember a choke?
Yeah.
It had a choke.
Of course I do remember a choke. I'm still choking from chokes.
The Voice of the UK. And the home of the Premier League. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Justine Green. The government has told British nationals that they should leave Lebanon as soon as possible because of the significant escalation in fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. The UK is sending additional troops to Cyprus as part of contingency plans to evacuate British people from Lebanon. Health officials there say more than 560 people have been killed in the past 48 hours. Israel said it hit hundreds of Hezbollah sites, accusing the militant group of hiding weapons in residential areas. Well, Chris Du is a journalist working for The Guardian in Beirut.
We've been seeing sites of mass bombing all over the country. We've been seeing it in Beirut itself, and we've been seeing the results of it. I mean, I went and I visited displacement centers around the city. The sites there are pretty grim, and just the streets of the city are filled with people who are just looking for a place to stay right now.
Sir Keir Starmer has warned of trade-offs in order to reform areas such as housing and energy in his first Labour conference speech as Prime Minister. Addressing delegates in Liverpool, he said he would resist easy answers to tough challenges, but said that there was light at the end of the tunnel. Our political correspondent Helen Catt says the party has shifted the tone.
If you think back a few weeks to Keir Starmer and his Rose Garden speech, and, you know, things will get worse was the message. The language around all of that was very bleak. And so certainly at this conference, we have seen a little bit of a change of tone. So you've still got a bit of that doom and gloom in there, but there is this repeated sense of things are happening, a change is beginning.
Several people have been arrested in Switzerland after a controversial assisted suicide device was used for the first time. The pod, named Sarko, allows people to kill themselves without the aid of a medic. It was used to end a woman's life in a hut in a forest in the north of the country. Officials said it breached Switzerland's laws allowing assisted suicide. The cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike has issued a new apology for the global disruption caused by one of its system updates in July. The incident led to global flight cancellations, as well as hitting banks, healthcare and media companies. A senior vice president at the company, Adam Myers, told a US congressional committee that the same mistakes wouldn't be repeated.
CrowdStrike was in the process of updating our customers on a new threat, or at least a content configuration update for the Windows sensor that did not work as expected. This resulted in Microsoft system crashes for a number of our users. On behalf of everyone at CrowdStrike, I want to apologize. We're deeply sorry, and we are determined to prevent this from ever happening again.
The Duke of Sussex has been talking about the dangers of social media. Speaking in New York, he suggested people were being used for a human experiment rather than enjoying a human experience, and that it was a crisis which couldn't be ignored. And the weather tonight, rain in Scotland will turn patchy and light as it moves into northern England. Elsewhere, it will be mostly dry. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past 12.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK.
On digital radio,
on BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Johnny Iamson.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live.
Welcome then, it's Johnny in for Gordon this evening. As ever, it's an absolute pleasure to be here, and I'm so looking forward to speaking to our next guest, because tonight on Life Less Ordinary is an incredibly accomplished musician, songwriter, producer, composer, a man whose career is taken in all aspects of the industry and spanned more than 50 years. A self-taught pianist, he's responsible for some of the country's most memorable pop songs. He's won multiple Ivor Novello Awards, has written and produced music for many artists, including Art Garfunkel, Cliff Richard, Elkie Brooks and David Essex. He's conducted many of the world's great orchestras and worked across many art forms, designing, directing and conducting. Recent years have witnessed him dedicate most of his time to the careers of other artists, including Vanessa May, Anna Maria Kaufman, Bond, The Planets, and he was responsible for discovering the unsigned and unknown Katie Melua when she was just 18. And I haven't even mentioned the Wombles yet. Now he's written a book called The Closest Thing to Crazy, My Life of Musical Adventures. He is, of course, Mike Batt. Welcome to the programme. How are you?
Oh, it's lovely to be here, Johnny, and lovely to see you. Yeah, it's that. Whoa, I could have if you'd given me a blank bit of paper and said write your own intro, I would have been embarrassed to have written that.
Really?
So thank you.
That doesn't touch the sides of it. I have to say one thing though, I've really enjoyed is you on social media, and I saw a fantastic Instagram post with you talking about your book, saying my autobiography is out now. It starts with me being born in one half of a bombed out house and ends with me. Well, here, where I am now, that's it.
And that's the end.
That's the end. Yeah. There might be another one, who knows? Read it if you can, and if not, take the dog for a walk. We're going to go into a little bit more detail this evening, but just on that broader experience of writing the book, has this been something which you've been doing all along your career or something you just decided on in recent times?
Well, I've always enjoyed writing, and I've written bits for newspapers and that sort of thing. Somebody would ring me up, an editor, and say, can you do 2,000 words on this, or that, or the other? You know, and that was lovely and flattering because I'm known as being a musician and a songwriter. So, but I do like writing prose, and I've always kept a diary.
Right.
Even though I've sometimes just for a whole year just not written a diary, and so I'd had to rely on desk diaries, and we've kept them all. You know, from 1968.
Really?
I've got my 1968 diary when I got signed and everything like that. So I've got lots of reference, but there are quite a few years where I've written whole narrative diaries, sort of Samuel Pepys style, you know, what you had for your dinner and whether you liked it or not and whether you're ever going to go there again. and then the fact that, you know, you were with someone that you liked a lot and why. All of that. And so I enjoyed the chronicling of that. But I never thought, oh, yeah, this is going to go in a book.
Yeah.
About 20 years ago, I mean, just over 20 years ago in 2001, I nearly got killed. I had a car crash that in Spain, the mountains of Spain. I was on the way to a video that I was directing of The Planets that
right.
you just mentioned. And, we smashed in, nearly came off the cliff, actually, but we smashed into a concrete block at 60 miles an hour.
Goodness me.
So I had this funny enough, my wife said to me, do you think it's changed your life? I think she was a bit disappointed when I said no. but it wasn't the road to Damascus, but it definitely made me think. I've always known life is finite, you know, without wanting to ramble on into a sort of philosophical thingy. But I don't know. I just thought I'm going to start writing my book in quotes, you know, because you mentioned social media. I would sometimes post a funny story about the Womble at the traffic lights, you know, and the police stopping and me putting the head on. I've sort of started, so I'll have to finish that one, where I actually put the Womble head on coming away from Top of the Pops, thinking that the traffic next car at the red traffic lights would just have a surprise.
Yeah.
And, of course, I would take the Womble head off, which happened to be on the seat next to me, when I drove off. And it turned out to be a police car. And the policeman turned to me and beckoned for me to wind the window down. And also, I was in a ridiculous bright blue Rolls Royce.
Of course you were.
23 years old.
It was the 70s.
Jack the Lad, you know. And I thought, oh, God, you know. So anyway, I poked my pointed nose out of the posh car, and the policeman in the passenger seat said, OK, Mr. Batt, you've had a little joke. Now, if you just take off the Womble head and drive off home carefully, we'll say no more about it. And that was just, you know, one of the lovely things that happens when you're a Womble.
Yeah. See, I love the fact that you have a life full of these stories. That would be one person's funniest life story, but you have these incredible moments and vignettes that you feature in the book, and we'll talk about those over the course of the next hour. Let's go back as probably is right to do in this instance, to the start of where it all began for you in terms of music and family life, because I know that you came from a, as you say, or as we spoke about before, a family that wasn't rich and you didn't have a huge amount.
No.
But music from very early on started to become an important part of your life, even to the point of where a grand piano was stuffed into this little house where you lived.
I mean, we weren't poor either. My dad was, he'd just come out of the army. He was an acting major at the age of 24 in the war. Of course, they promoted people fast, you know. Royal Engineers. And so we would move around the country when he moved to a new job. And for a bit more promotion, we might move from Southampton to get another job in Bradford. And we'd be 3 years here, 2 years there. So we went down to Winchester. And I think one of the reasons we didn't have a lot of money was because we had four kids. Oh, my mum and dad had four kids. And it all had to be, you know, who's going to get the shoes this, who's going to get a new pair of shoes this month? That was the kind of level it was on, but it was still, you got a pair of shoes. But, so the grand piano, we got to Winchester and I was allocated the downstairs front bedroom because we only had three bedrooms. It was a nice little detached house. It was the first time we'd ever lived in a detached house. It was a very nice leafy avenue, but it was small. And, I saw this, it's a 7-foot grand piano and it's free. Please come and take it away. So my dad said, go on then, let's do it. So we got this flatbed truck and we moved it. Obviously you have to take all the legs off and got it sideways into the room. But by the time we stood it up, it took up the whole room so that you couldn't actually open the door. You had to open the door just enough to squeeze in and you had to crawl underneath the piano to get into the room. So that was that story. I lived in that room and I had to sort of crawl into it every time I wanted to go in and out of it.
How old were you when you first remember playing music or listening to music? I know you used to sort of conduct music as a kid.
Yeah.
Pretending to conduct but it was certainly
role playing,
yeah. But that would become your life. How old were you or your earliest memories of when that was happening and music became a really important part of your life?
Well, my family wasn't what you call a, quote, musical family. So I didn't have everyone pushing me to say, oh, yeah, learn the violin or whatever. So I was about at least 10 or 11 before I started thinking, oh, I quite like music. And I must have been 11 or 12. That was about the time we moved down to Winchester and I got the grand piano and a kid at school taught me to play the accordion, a Polish kid called Kaz Nowakowski, one of my mates. I could ramble on and tell you that Kaz Nowakowski and his two brothers all played for Sheffield Wednesday, but I won't.
It would then be a few years and you end up playing the organ in a strip club. Is that right?
That's right.
That's where you honed your chops.
Yeah, I didn't look for a job in a strip club.
Right.
You know, it's not sort of...
I mean, you were 15 years old, so I'll take that as, gospel.
I was about maybe 16 or 17 by the time I got that job because I'd left school by then. I left after A-levels, which would have been late 17. I was probably 17 and a half or something. And, I got a job to stay alive. I basically said to my dad, look, I don't want you to support me, although I'd like to live at home occasionally, but I would like you to tolerate the idea that I'm not going to try and get into university or art school or anything like that. If they'll have me, which none of them had said they wanted me anyway. So I had terrible A levels, really. I had an A in English, which showed I wasn't a complete idiot. But I had an E in music and an E in art.
No, you didn't.
Which are my two the best subjects, you know. I was definitely, dare I say, I was the best art guy in school, definitely.
Right.
No question. Which sounds really immodest. I'm just being honest.
Yeah.
Trying not to use up too much of your airwaves.
No, that's
being modest.
What did it teach you playing the organ in a strip club? I mean, that's a bygone thing, isn't it? Having live music in a strip club. So I hear, having never been.
It wasn't. It only became a strip club twice a week. The rest of the time, it was just a sort of louche drinking club for guys, middle-aged guys, to go and drink away their wages, whatever. And it was sort of very Copacabana sort of decorated. It was very... you know, sort of aspirational, I'd call it that. Yeah,
yeah.
And there was a little band, a drummer who ran the band, and there was a bass player who was the milkman. He went straight to the dairy at 4 o'clock in the morning after we finished and did his rounds.
Right.
And I was the organist. And definitely on Saturdays, we were descended upon by, I describe it in the book as three ladies of sparsely clothed potential.
Right.
And they did their act and we did the music. We were upstage with them. So when they turned away from the audience to sort of protect their modesty, we got the good news.
I mean, as fantastic as that job sounds, Mike, I guess you didn't see your career staying there for a long time.
No.
You end up joining Liberty Records, yep, writing for them, being picked up at aged 18 through a job advert in NME. I mean, this is such an amazing thing to think about, that a record, yeah, company would say, apply to be a songwriter,
I know,
with us.
I was astonished. It was the same one that famously Elton John, who was just Red Dwight at that time,
yeah,
also, and Bernie, Taupin.
And they didn't know each other at this
no,
time,
they didn't.
They?
So Ray Williams, who actually put the advert in, he teamed them up, having received the lyrics from Bernie by post.
Right.
But Elton went in person. I might have been in the reception area, you know, across from him, and we didn't just know each other at that time. Yeah, and that was a real, not like a culture shock, but it was thrilling, the fact that someone wanted to sign me at all. Mm. You know, I'd had people express an interest, junior A&R men, who would come say, you know, I can't really hear a song, there's a hit yet, but I like your stuff, so come and see me again. And people like, well, there was a guy who became George Michael's publisher and general, you know, advisor, lovely guy called Dick Leahy, who was a junior A&R man then, and he said, you know, come and see me again. And nothing ever really happened with that, but that's how I got my contacts, and I... While I was actually playing in the strip club to get, you know, whatever pittance it was a week, I was using that pittance, plus getting a bit more from my mum probably, to go from Winchester to London to see these people.
Mm.
And so during the day I was a would-be artist songwriter / please sign me up.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the night it was doing the Copacabana.
When you were writing songs then, when you signed to Liberty and this becomes your career, did you always have aspirations still of being a performer yourself? Because that for me must be an incredibly difficult thing to try and relinquish if you have that dream of being a frontman, but then all of a sudden you start writing for others. And I know that's something that has been a theme throughout your career, but at that moment, did you still want to be a solo performer, or a performer, I should say?
Yeah, and I've never stopped that. I initially got signed by Liberty. You're right, you know, record companies usually say, get lost. You know, they don't say, please come and see us. And so that was a fantastic thing, opportunity. That was sort of the kernel of that little story, wasn't it? And the fact that I'd got the chance, I mean, it was everything. I grabbed it with both hands. But being an artist was what I always wanted. I wanted to be Cat Stevens. I loved his stuff. He was only like 3 or 4 years older than me, a bit further ahead on the conveyor belt. The Beatles were like 7, 8 years older than me.
Yeah.
So I started getting interested in them when I was 12. And I was going to go into the army or something like that. I was quite interested in the cadets and everything. And then around about 17, I thought, no, I'd like to do, and I'd been in bands and played in the pub and whatever, and was learning to do it and enjoying it. So that thing about wanting to be an artist has always been there. And frankly, I even when I was a Womble, I was still an artist.
Mm.
And when I was, and post Womble, I was sort of putting my hand up going to people like the Whistle Test. And guys, I'm an artist standing over here. What was that? Sounds like a bit from a Hugh Grant film, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm just an artist standing in front of a producer, please. But you couldn't get on the Grey Whistle Test if you had only just recently been Orinoco.
Right.
You know, they didn't really take you seriously. But in Germany, I was selling hundreds of thousands of proggy sort of songy orchestral rock and roll albums and in other countries as well.
Well, we're going to play the Wombles and talk about them in just 1 minute's time, but as something which I think is indicative of you and your career, you risked a lot of money by financing your own prog rock opera record.
Yeah.
Which I think you described as Led Zepp meets Bartok.
Yeah.
Which, you know, most people of the time, I guess, you know, prog rock was becoming a thing. Rock opera maybe was yeah, an emerging genre then. But to fund it all yourself and try and do it all yourself.
I could only fund it myself because I lucked into some money. It was a very dodgy existence. It was up and down. You know, am I going to get a job to arrange some trumpets for Johnny Nash this week, which I did one time. Lived in a little flat in Earl's Court, you know. And am I going to get some top lines to write or some strings for something? So that's how I was making my living at that time. And I was poor as a church mouse, arse hanging out of my jeans, but not quite as much as my fellow church mice, who were also trying to get a hit, you know, producers and writers, because I was doing jingles as well, and that meant I only had one hole in my jeans, and right, they all had, you know, no jeans. Anyway, so I was making a living, but I was just fantasizing one day to my first wife. I was saying, do you know what? I need £11,000. And she said, what do you want that for? Well, of course, there's lots of reasons why you might want £11,000. You could buy a three-bedroom house in those days for £11,000.
Right.
How did I get the £11,000? Well, I got out of jail free because I rang up the TV production company. And the reason that I got into this trouble was that they had, without telling me, put my music onto 52 half-hours of television, running all the time in the background while this guy was doing his yoga exercises.
Right.
And it all across America. And it was happening. I didn't even know it was happening. And then one day I went in, the day after I'd been moaning to my first wife that I quite liked 11,000 quid, I went into my office, which is with Chapels in Maddox Street, and on the mat was a cheque for 11,000 quid. I mean, like, as if Father Christmas had been listening.
That's called manifestation now, Mike. It's very trendy at the moment.
Is it? Oh, yeah. I'll do a bit more then. I'll try and get more trendy. Yeah, sort of, manifestation. That's a great word.
Sadly, it wasn't the success you'd hoped it would be.
No.
And ended up costing you quite a lot of money, and you didn't get the work from it.
Funnily enough, you remarked quite wryly that I was sitting in the in reception just now, reading my book, even though I know every word of it from page to page. I just opened it and thought, I've got it here. My eyes landed on that very story. And I remember going to America to try and sell that big project before the Wombles happened. And I was in the office of a guy called Kip Cohen, who was the head of A&R for Sony, CBS. And he played my record, 20-minute record, a huge volume all the way through, declared it literally to be a masterpiece, said it was fantastic, enthusiastically took my details, how can he get hold of me and everything else, heaped me with praise, and I never heard from him again. Mm. That isn't the only story like that, but yeah. By the time you've told one, why tell the others? And I'm sure there's lots of your listeners that have got stories like that as well.
And that's called being ghosted, so it's been happening for a long time. Yeah. Now, you mentioned the Wombles, and we have to play this.
Underground, overground, wombling free, the Wombles of Wimbledon, common are we, making good use of the things that we find.
I have to say, it's a wonderfully surreal moment for me to be sat with an actual Womble and the man who wrote it, and to be talking to him about it and looking him in the eye, because even though I was a child of the 80s, this still had huge resonance for me in my childhood.
It's funny that, isn't it, how it did go across the generations when actually it didn't. You wouldn't think it would. I mean, I think there is a lost generation of people that go, excuse me, but what's a Womble? But not all of them do. You might meet the odd girl of, I don't know, age 36 or something. You might, no, I missed that.
Everybody knows the Wombles. Anybody worth their salt knows the Wombles. Let's put it that way, Mike. Take me to 1974. Someone comes to you and says, hey, we've got this TV show.
Yeah.
Do you want to write the theme tune? Here's 200 quid.
Yeah.
And what did you say?
I said, I really need that 200 quid because that hole in my jeans was getting bigger. And I said, you know what? I love these characters so much that, because 200 quid then was about 2000 now.
Right.
I looked it up the other day.
Really?
Yeah. And that was a good fee.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll tell you what, give me the character rights to do musical things. Not everything, not books, obviously. The characters existed already. Elizabeth Beresford wrote the books and there was one novel. And so I didn't want all the rights. I couldn't have had all the rights. I didn't want them. But I did want the right to do to make records. And
yeah.
And so and that would, along with that, would go in the it would imply that I wanted to make a pop group out of them if I ever wanted to, which I didn't set out to do. I just wrote, I just made the record. And then there's a story about how it got promoted and everything.
Yeah.
But I'm obviously trying to clip the wings of my ramblingness a little bit so that I don't get you sucked into a sort of three hour discussion about how we broke the Wombles. But it was fun, and it was hot and furry and sweaty.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. And what a choice of yours, though, to turn down that 200 quid and say, I'll take the royalties.
Yeah.
Instead, that was a genius move.
Well, it wasn't. I didn't think it was a genius move at the time. It was just a sensible move. And it was my way of getting to do something artistically, which I wanted to do, because I really did want to write a song about Great Uncle Bulgaria.
Right.
And Madame Chollet.
Yeah.
Madame Chollet, what's cooking for you today? You know, we think you're a real cool pie.
This though goes beyond a TV program, doesn't it? It becomes this cultural phenomenon, really. And I don't want to overstate that, but I read an amazing stat that you had 8 top 10 hits in 74 and 75. 4 gold albums, and in 1974 you were the biggest selling single band of that year.
Yeah.
And the only band since the Beatles to have 3 top 50 hits simultaneously.
Yeah, which happened for 2 weeks in June. So we celebrated that this June, 50 years on, that we had 3 in the top 40 at the same time as the Beatles, which is the first time it had ever been done since the Beatles.
Amazing.
Of course, these days you often get, you know, every Taylor Swift track.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very different world now, Mike, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you had to shift a lot of units, to use industry speak, to get into the top 40, let alone the top 10.
I think part of it was I was so scared that I wouldn't be able to follow it up. That while the first one was still up there, I was writing, beating away,
getting
another one out.
You know?
And I was thinking they were going to come sliding down the charts, but the first one stayed in the charts and hovered for so long. And I thought, I better get a third one out because it must come out soon. And by the time the third one came out, the first two were still in the charts, and that's why it happened.
Did you worry at the time, though, Mike, that you would become this pastiche of a musician? You would be pigeonholed as a novelty record writer?
I kind of knew it was happening anyway because of the derision of the New Musical Express and various cool people. Whereas a lot of other people, you know, like 85% probably of the market, and there's me as a record, talking like a record executive. But most people who watch the Mork and Wise show or Top of the Pops or just the family audience thought the Wombles were great.
Mm.
But you know, these sort of rather snotty, occasional NME Melody Maker writers, you know, they just thought of me as a lightweight. Because at that time, that's to them what I'd all that I'd demonstrated. Although, funny enough, John Peel had his eye on me from when, earlier on when I was doing, you talked about being an artist. When I first started being an artist, he used to, you know, tip people off about me. And as soon as I started doing the Wombles, I lost him.
Really?
Yeah.
Really.
And you know.
I can't believe that the music press would be snobby, Mike. Surely not.
Yeah. Well, of course it sells papers, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know? So you got a mansion from it. So I don't imagine you were that fussed, were you?
No. I mean, to be honest with you, it was like manna from heaven.
Yeah.
Because I know it sounds almost antisocial to say this on a program that's being listened to by people of all different layers of experience, wealth, and everything, and the opposite, that we suddenly went from struggling like mad and sometimes not being able to pay, you know, the mortgage, whatever, and to being literally rich.
What was that like? What's it like being rich? Because you were living on a houseboat before.
Yeah, and the houseboat was fine. I mean, as long as I'll say it and you can cut it out if you don't like it. As long as the bucket of shit didn't fall over as you were rowing the Elson toilet disposal thing over the canal that day,
yeah.
You were fine.
You weren't worrying about chemical toilets in your 11-bed mansion that you bought with your million quid from the bottom.
No, I didn't. And so it was lovely to be thrown into this world where where policemen actually looked up to you, and not looked up to you, but said, called you sir, and gave you crime prevention advice.
Even if you were dressed as a womble in a Rolls Royce.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. It's weird, though, how people treat you. And conversely, when you're not doing well,
yeah,
how people treat you then, you know.
So you go on then, you manage to move away from the Wombles, although they will be forever present, obviously.
Yeah.
And how could they not be?
Yeah.
And you move on to work with the likes of Steel Eye Span. You did All Around My Heart. You did Elkie Brooks, loads of big artists at the time. Was that quite a liberating thing for you to feel like you were getting back to the essence of what you were about as a singer-songwriter? And did you want to leave the Wombles behind?
This is a really interesting thing I found, because people do ask me this, you know, quite a lot. It's an obvious thing that everyone wants to know. It's as common a question as what comes first, the lyrics or the music. You know?
Well, that was my next question, but carry on.
Yeah. But I sort of wanted to leave them behind only because I wanted to get on with doing my serious stuff, which was a continuation of the stuff I'd tried to sell to this Kip Cohen and everyone else in America.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't necessarily heavy. That was a heavy rock album. And if that had succeeded, the Wombles would never have happened, because I wouldn't have needed it.
Yeah. Well, you would have been Yes or...
Yeah.
Or whoever.
Genesis or...
Yeah, Genesis.
Or something else. Or I'd have gone more symphonic, probably a bit harder rock.
Yeah.
Than them, I think, because that's where I'm driven, really, is quite heavy.
But it must have been nice for you to get back, because you had that financial security thanks to the Wombles.
Yeah.
So you could then focus on what you love doing and writing and working with people like Elkie Brooks and what have you.
Yeah, but also meant that the record company, which is CBS, obviously now Sony, who... I was making a lot of money for them as well as for myself.
Mm.
And they were giving me plenty of artistic latitude to make the solo albums I wanted to, which were selling in other countries. So I was still being an artist.
Yeah.
Being a bit of a rock star, actually, to be honest with you. But secretly, because no one in England knew about it. Luckily, the Wombles didn't happen anywhere else. They only happened in England. So that's where the only time I have the big shadow of the Wombles over me.
Yeah.
And if you ask somebody in Germany, they'll say, what, Wombles? I think I've heard of them, but...
I mean, try explaining the Wombles to somebody in a foreign country. It's just, not going to do
are you? Only because they weren't that big as a rock act. They were on television as a kid's thing.
Mm.
But there you go.
Let's fast forward to 1978. You were writing for lots of people and working with lots of people. And then somebody asked you to write a song for a film called Watership Down.
Bright eyes, burning like fire. Bright eyes, how can you close and fail? How can the light that burns so brightly suddenly burn so pale?
That is such a good line. How can the light that burns so brightly suddenly burn so pale? Wow. I mean, there'll be many people listening to this who will think, hang on, that's Art Garfunkel's song.
Yeah.
But you wrote that song. You were commissioned to write a song about death. And I know that that was it's a difficult thing to kind of wrap your head around.
Absolutely. I mean, you think, how can I write a song about death?
Yeah.
You know, it's such a hard subject. And then the more I thought about it, the more it resonated with... Isn't this what we all think about? You know, one of the biggest questions, what happens when you die?
There's a universality about it, isn't there? Of course
there is. Yeah, so I started to think, well, I don't know what happens when we die. I don't claim to now. I mean, I haven't got a religion that would make me believe that there is an afterlife, or that there is a God, or that there isn't a God, or that there is an afterlife. You know, I mean, again, without trying to dive into a philosophical, theological conversation here too much, my feeling is that it's none of my business. I've just got to get on with life and do the best I can.
It's a great way of looking at it.
Be the best human being I can.
Yeah.
And I'm not intended to know, you know. Just like an ant isn't intended to know how big the piece of cheese is on top of my fridge, you know. Meanwhile, back at the question.
When you wrote this, because you had people in mind, and I know you said to the record company, send it to Art Garfunkel, but they'll probably say no, but we've got a list of other people. But did you know, oh, that's a That's a bona fide hit. Do you have that sense when you write something like this?
That was a magic one because I knew it was for a movie, so that gave it a bit of
Had you seen the film at that
point? No, I hadn't made it.
Oh, really?
It was literally a book
right.
with a script,
right.
half a script
oh,
and a bit of a drawing made. Yeah, that was it. And so I did it in 1976. It didn't come out till 1979. So 3 years in between it, recording it, and then it coming out. So that was quite tough because they chucked it off the film 3 times.
No.
Yeah, because they didn't want Dirty Rotten songs in it. They didn't want it to be like a Disney movie.
Right.
It was a serious film this was going to be, you know. So, but luckily they put it back 3 times as well. Getting my head into that and deciding that I could write this mystical sort of song about what happens, you know. That thing about, you know, as you said, you pointed out very kindly, you know, how can a light that burns so brightly suddenly burn so pale? That's what you think when someone dies. I mean, I actually hadn't really experienced the loss of many people. I mean, my granny had died, but I didn't know her very well. But when my own dad died only about 20 years ago, literally, you know, seeing, you know, forgive the poignancy of the subject matter, but seeing him immediately afterwards, those eyes were dead.
Wow.
And there was nothing coming out.
Yeah.
He'd gone.
Yeah.
He wasn't there.
Yeah.
It wasn't him.
It's a metaphor that I think a lot of people can relate to.
Mm.
And it's really interesting because I remember I think I must have been 8 years old at primary school singing that song.
Really?
Yeah, I remember watching the film. I mean, anybody who's watched that film, A Kid of the 80s, is emotionally scarred to this day from
yeah,
watching
Watership
Down.
Yeah, I know, and it's vicious, isn't it?
Oh, my God, Mike. I don't think I could watch it again right now. But, you know, to know that you had written this piece of work that had touched so many different people and that had travelled around the globe in so many ways must be an incredible feeling. But I always wonder with something like that, particularly because you are a performer, did you wish that it was you that was singing and performing it?
In that case, no. I mean, there have been times where... No, I don't think I've ever been jealous of the acts I've been working with for their success. There have been times... Later on with Katie Melua, I had a little moment where I thought, oh, it must be so nice to be sort of taken out of your A levels and suddenly you're a massive star.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to go around in a white van and do all the toilets, as we call the bars, where you have to play. But I don't really have that kind of jealousy thing. Of course, I'm jealous of pretty much everyone in the world who's more successful than me and has had lots of American hits and whatever you might not have achieved. I remembered the other day thinking to myself when I came off the stage after the Glastonbury Womble gig. We did it in 2011, you know, and I was already, you know, getting on for being quite old. I was 61 then. I remember afterwards being so exhausted and so exhilarated because we had a massive crowd. And the people at Glastonbury told us they had a crowdometer. And they have a machine that counts the people. And they came up to me afterwards and they said, you had the biggest audience anywhere, including the pyramid stage, that afternoon.
No.
The exhilaration of coming off stage after doing the Wombles at 61, which answers your question about do I want the Wombles to go away? No, I don't, because it's so joyful and wonderful. And the exhilaration, I'd expressed it by saying to myself, sometimes when I'm envious of my heroes, I think to myself, you know what, Leonard Bernstein and Frank Zappa never got to play a one-hour fully live set at Glastonbury in a Womble costume.
True story.
And it's a kind of lovely, cuddly, warm feeling to have. And of course, they had lovely other experiences that completely aced mine. But nevertheless,
yeah.
You know,
but playing Glastonbury in a Womble outfit, there's very few people that can say that.
Yeah.
You name dropped a couple of people there, and the book is littered with great stories. I want you to tell me briefly the story about you being given a tour of Paul McCartney, Sir Paul McCartney's studios, Montserrat Studios.
That's right, yeah.
And there being somebody else there at the time whose session you interrupted.
Actually, Paul didn't own the studio.
Right.
He was the client at the studio.
He was working
there. Owned by George Martin.
Sorry, yes.
So I went off on a boat for 2 years, like you do. You know.
Sailed around the world.
And we were anchored off Montserrat because I was checking out their studio because George had built a fantastic studio, which a lot of people know, that he had Air Studios Montserrat. And I went along, I thought, this is perfect. We're in Antigua, anchored there. So we just did a one-day trip to Montserrat, and we anchored off there, and went in to check the studio out. And happened that George was there, so he personally showed me around. And then a Jeep pulled up, and out of the Jeep, I'd never met him, got Paul McCartney. And he's walking up the little pathway in a little garden to make me feel at ease, which is a lovely trait he's got. He does try and make people feel, because he must know how terrified people are of meeting him, you know. He came up the pathways, and as he got towards me and George, he started singing, "Big tits wobbling like jelly." And I thought, yeah, and we all fell about laughing.
This is Sir Paul McCartney singing this.
Yeah, and it's his way of saying, I know who you are,
yeah,
and I know what you've written. And that's a lovely, lovely trait.
What an amazing thing. And then he took you around the studio and there was somebody else in there.
He did, and the next day, yeah, they came aboard for dinner, actually. It was rather posh. They came aboard by boat and all had dinner, Denny Lane and Paul and Linda and George and Carl Perkins, who was at Montserrat to write and perform with Paul.
Right.
Yeah, so Paul said, come after dinner, he said, next tomorrow, come in, drop in the studio and I'll, you know, you can watch what we're doing because Stevie Wonder's coming. I went down the next day and Paul said, we're just putting these drums on, but I want to show you this thing. It's a new thing called a Lynn drum.
It's an electric drum machine.
Yeah, but it was the first one we'd ever seen that was any good, you know. And he said, Stevie brought one with him, and he's brought one for me as well, me, Paul McCartney. And so he said, come on, I'll show it to you. So he opened the door of the studio, and I could hear someone drumming really loudly. I thought, we shouldn't really be doing this, coming in, because he was saying, right, now what you do with, here's the Lynn drum, and you just turn that switch and a bass drum starts up. And then you, if you do that, the snare drum starts to go, and the hi hat, and he's talking quite loudly to me because we can't be heard above the drums, and George, and Linda, are in the control room looking through the glass. Stevie's doing the drums for Ebony and Ivory, right, and he's looking up at the, you know, like he always does, looking up as he plays. And he starts going, what's on? I can hear someone, people talking. And Paul goes, it's all right, Stevie. I've just got Mike here. By the way, this is Mike. This is Stevie. And he went, yeah. Anyway, and then George Martin, the very posh, you know, privately educated voice of George Martin comes across the tannoy saying, boys, do you think you could just possibly try and do that Lynn drum thing somewhere else at another time, because I'm trying to record Stevie on the drums here? And of course we sheepishly left the studio. The funny thing was that Linda said to me, you should never do that. You should never go in the studio when someone's playing. And I thought, well, I know that. I know.
Paul McCartney told me to go in there.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't say no to Paul McCartney. Yeah, what a fantastic story.
And the funny thing was, she wasn't telling him off.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, it's Paul McCartney.
It's a sort of pecking order, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's impressive company to keep. That wasn't the only Beatle that you met, because you worked with George Harrison.
George, yeah.
Quite a bit.
Well, not quite a bit. Not as much as I'd like to have, because he put a lovely solo on a project of mine called The Hunting of the Snark.
Mm.
And I went to his house in Henley, and he put a beautiful solo on. He used that bottleneck like he had on My Sweet Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to know each other sort of socially, and Julianne, my wife, and him and his wife, you know, we Olivia, we got to know each other, and we'd sort of go around for dinner in the kitchen, that sort of thing. There's one lovely story about how he was on the phone with me, and he'd said, look, I loved working with you. Dare I say this? It sounds too big-headed, but I'll say it anyways. I really enjoyed working with you on the Snark project, but he said, let's do some writing together. And so we talked for a while, and I said, well, there were two things on that conversation I remember very clearly. I said, so what sort of time have you got in mind? When do you think I should come round? He said, Well, if you jumped out of the wardrobe now, it wouldn't be too soon. That was the first thing that made me laugh. And the second thing was I got round to asking the question again as he was off on a tangent, something, talking about something else. And I said, OK, so when are we going to write this masterpiece, St. George? He said, well, actually, something crap would do to start with. And I thought that was really great.
What was it? I mean, you must have... Obviously, you spent a lifetime around these people, but nevertheless, bumping into Paul McCartney and interrupting a drumming session for Ebony and Ivory with Stevie Wonder, or having dinner with George Harrison.
Yeah.
There must have been surreal pinch-me moments, or was that just your showbiz life then?
No, it was pinch-me. I think I was just thrilled that... I mean, being such a Beatle fan, I think anybody... I mean, you know, if you ask Elvis Costello... I don't know Elvis Costello, but I'm sure, you know, he has worked a lot with Paul. I bet he was delighted. And Jeff Lynne. You know, Jeff Lynne came along just after I had worked with George, and he put a lot more time into it, because I was actually having... I had too much going on. It wasn't that I didn't have time for George. I mean, for George Harrison, of course.
I didn't have time for George Harrison.
Sorry, George, I'll call you back. You know? It wasn't like that. But I was also, I had the Phantom of the Opera was sort of juggling and writing that first song. The Phantom of the Opera, that one, with Andrew, which was the only thing I ever did towards that project.
Well, I mean, that story is still some contribution, though.
Yes, I'd like to think it was the genesis of the whole thing, but, you know, I mean, I only co-wrote that one song, and even then some of my lyrics were replaced later because it's a theatrical project and all that. I was still doing that, and there was a possibility I might have gone and done the whole musical.
Mm.
So I was sort of juggling three projects, George, Harrison... Hello. Yeah. What decision is there? Surely I should. But I can't not do the snark. And I'm just been asked if I could write the lyrics of the Phantom of the Opera.
These are lovely problems to have, though, Mike. It's like a surreal life with, you know, lovely problems to have.
Yeah, you know that. I started nearly going, feeling like that. The guy in the producers who needs his blue blanket.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Oh, give me my blue blanket. Because yeah, he's sort of nervous about making the decisions.
Much like Watership Down and The Wombles, there's another song as well, which people may not necessarily associate you with, but one that perennially comes round and is a firm fixture in many people's households. Certainly one of ours at a certain time of the year as well.
It was only a winter's day, just another winter's day, and why should the world take notice of one more love that's fading?
Now everybody loves Christmas, Mike. But especially those people that have written hit Christmas records as well. And when you talk to people in the music world, you know, they love what they do, but if they could just get a hit Christmas record, that royalty check every January sees them through the rest of the year. Well, I mean, this was a very different time, wasn't it, writing Christmas records when they would be huge. It's a different time now, I guess.
It is. And actually, that song was written to try to be a hit at Christmas but not mention Christmas.
Yeah.
So it was a winter record.
Yeah.
And it was about a real story in my life of a girl that I knew we would never be able to...
Unrequited
love. That can never be.
Right.
Although it meant a lot to you and me. It was about... Because Tim Rice came round to my house and I said, David Essex rang me yesterday and said, can I write him a Christmas song? And you're here and there's a pub down the road. Why don't you go down and have a pint and talk about it?
Your life is just one long fever dream, it sounds like, Mick. It just...
These days it's a fever tree rather than... But in those days it was a pint of Guinness. And I told... I poured my heart out to Tim. And Tim actually co-wrote the lyric with me. No, he said, let's go back. I was living at my sister's house at the time. I was going through a divorce, let's be honest about it. And he said, look, maybe we can kill two birds with one stone and give David his Christmas hit and tell your love story of unrequited love, yeah, which was only unrequited because of geography. You know, the girl lived a long way away and circumstances were terrible. My personal life was, you know, in going through a tough period, to put it that way. And so... that's what it was about. And it actually wasn't a hit until middle of January, which nevertheless didn't matter. It was still number two.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't been for that rotter, Phil Collins, with "It Can't Hurry Love" at number one, which would not shift, we'd have had a number one. But yeah, again, you can't go through life regretting the fact that you only had a number two. With
no, I mean, there's, you know, there's, you've got to put it in perspective, haven't you?
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah.
The hits kept coming, and then you're, you know, there's the ebb and the flow of a career, inevitably, as there is. And I'm just conscious of time, because we could all night talking to you, Mike. We really could. You know, things get tough, and particularly in the wake of Hunting the Snark as well, because it wasn't as successful as you wanted to be.
No, I was completely on the floor.
Yeah, so financially things get very difficult for you. And then you strike gold with Vanessa May, the classical violinist. And I remember that period when classical music crossover was starting to become a real thing.
Yeah.
And then in 2003, you discover a certain Katie Melua.
This is the closest thing to crazy I have ever been. Feeling 22, acting 17. This is the nearest thing to crazy I have ever been. And being close to you.
I mean, if you turned on the radio or any talk show around 2003, and then after a few years afterwards, Katie Melua was on it performing that song, and 9 Million Bicycles as well. Both of your records, which you co-wrote with her. Co-wrote or wrote?
Wrote.
Wrote, right, so you wrote. Which is really interesting, because she was definitely presented, and is, but presented as a singer, an independent singer-songwriter.
Well, she... It did. I mean, she. How can I put it? I was looking for someone to sing my songs, but also, she was a Brit School student, and I eventually found. I saw an awful lot of people when I was looking.
Were you auditioning?
I was.
How does it
actually work?
Right.
I went.
You sat
around
there like a Svengali with.
Well,
just
I tried to. I tried to sort of shuffle into the room, in the least Svengali-like pose possible, but I did. I went to this place called BIM in Brighton, but the Brits hadn't had an artist break out from Brit School at that time. But I went to the Brit School, and I'd put a notice on their notice board and said, "I'm looking for someone who's got something of the Eva Cassidy in their voice." So I wanted someone of that level of artistry. Anyway, I just was. Effectively, I would have settled for someone really good. And it just struck me on the first time when she, after having done the audition, and I said, "Why don't you try and embellish that bit a bit?" I wanted to find out how she thought, not just how she sounded, because I could hear how she sounded, but I wanted to hear what musicality she had in her mind. And she just delivered this kind of like twiddle. That's all I can describe it as, like an embellishment. And it wasn't sort of X Factor book of embellishments, number 326, hashtag. It was totally original. And I actually burst out laughing with the engineer. Not that she could either hear or see us. She was down the other end of the house. The studio was in my house. And the reason I was laughing wasn't out of derision or anything like that. It was completely the opposite. It was just this joy to know that I'd found someone who wasn't just really good. She was great. And I know there's some people out there still who think, "Well, really? Are you really sure about that?" And yes, I am, because she had this... I don't know whether it's partly from being from Georgia in Eastern Europe, the tradition of the singing. And she had... things like breath control that you just can't learn. She would sing a song, sing a line, and I'd think, right, she's going to breathe now, and then she'd go into the next line. And no, she wouldn't. She'd just drop into it. And then, of course, she's going to breathe after that one. No, she just decides she's going to slip. And it was I describe it in the book as like a bird on a sort of wind, warm wind. She would just slip into the next line. And to get back to your thing about the fact that she appeared like a singer-songwriter, it was because she was a singer-songwriter. Mm. And I felt that it would have been a terrible thing for a producer to have said, right, go and stand at that microphone and sing my song and only my song and do 12 of my songs.
Yeah.
Because that would have been to crush her own ambitions as a writer. So we included a couple of her songs on the first album, three or four on the second album and so on, so that gradually... I think it's still, I'll be honest, and if she's listening, I hope she doesn't mind me saying this, but I think it did irk her that she was seen by people in the industry as the bloke that sang Mike Batt's songs.
Yeah.
But she sang them so well.
Well, and also, you know, she is a great talent, but especially in around that period, you don't become the biggest selling female artist in the world as she was in 2005
yeah.
just because you sing other people's good songs. You have to have an incredible talent.
Exactly. I mean, look at someone like Dusty Springfield. Mm. Never wrote a song. Well, she might have written a song here or there, but she was never thought of as a songwriter.
Yeah.
I know it's at different times, and when I came across Katie, it was very much, you know, you've got to be cool and you've got to write your own stuff. And we accommodated that, and I became what we called, she and I used to, well, I probably coined the phrase, I was a song doctor.
Yeah.
I was a sort of like a university professor of songwriting. You know? Okay, play me your new song. I think it just needs a slight lift in the second line to give it more melody, but I won't write it. You do it, but that's my suggestion. So it was like song doctoring, as I called it.
There is so much we could talk to you about, Mike, but as I say, we just don't have enough time tonight, but there's loads more in the book, which is well, well worth a read. It's brilliant. It's called The Closest Thing to Crazy, which is the appropriate way to finish my life of musical adventures. Thank you so much for being with us, Mike Batt. Just a final thing. Paul McCartney said that when he was asked which song he wished he'd written, that he'd wished he'd written Bright Eyes. And you said at the time, that's it, I can die happy.
Yeah.
But actually, that isn't in you, is it? Because you wanted more and you still want to do more as well.
Yes.
I just wondered what it was and what it is that just keeps you going in the world of music.
Well, I've got to tell you, I've had quite an up and down life. I mean, you talked about how I'd crashed and hit the floor when we did the Hunting the Snark in the West End, even though I think it's one of my absolutely best works and I still would like to see something happen with it. So sometimes digging a hole and falling into it is a great way to give yourself the energy to climb out. And while you're climbing out, you could create something great. And honestly do think that that has given me a life energy that I wouldn't have had if I'd just had the Wombles as a success and then bought a block of flats and retired at the age of 24. I'd have probably found something interesting to do, like race cars or buy, you know. I don't know, but the fact that I've had to struggle quite often to get over a lump or a hump of unsuccessful stuff or stuff that I thought was my best work but no one else agreed. Mm. You know, the very fact that I've had to struggle, I think, is what it is. And so I didn't find out. I mean, someone sent me that YouTube thing of Paul McCartney. It was actually in the days before I met him. I met him in 1980 when I was on my boat trip, as I've just said. But in 1979 or something like 79, yeah, it must have been because Bright Eyes was then. Someone was interviewing him and they said, what songs do you think are good apart from your own? He listed a couple of Billy Joel and one of my Bright Eyes. And the guy said, which ones do you wish you'd written? And he said, well, Bright Eyes.
Wow.
And I thought, whoa. I mean, that's the guy, this is the guy that I was going mad for at 12 when I was a complete Beatle fan. And I never thought I'd even meet him, never mind have him. I didn't even think I would ever write a song at that point. I was just a 12-year-old, you know. And then one day he actually says, I would quite like to have written that.
What an amazing testimony to your talent. Mike, it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much, our guest on Life Less Ordinary tonight, Mike Batt. It's been an absolute pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you, Johnny. It's been great.
The Wombles of Wimbledon, common are we, making good use of the things that we find, things that the everyday folks leave behind. Mm-hmm.
Well, we could only finish on one thing, couldn't we? That was absolutely wonderful. Life Less Ordinary Tonight was courtesy of the brilliant Mike Batt. His book, The Closest Thing to Crazy, My Life of Musical Adventures. What a guy. Really enjoyed that. That's it from us tonight. Thank you so much for your company. As ever, thanks to the team, Paul and Shalomi in the studio, and Joe and John producing, and of course, Adrian pulling all the strings. The nightclub is next. Dotun Adebayo is on the door. I'll speak to you soon and see you tomorrow.
Yeah, Johnny, thanks very much. So, amongst the other things we're talking about on the nightclub is the Prime Minister wants to look after our health, to save the NHS. Should he legislate, though, to force us to live the lifestyles that would benefit the NHS or not? Your thoughts, please.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 1 o'clock. This is Justine Green. Sir Keir Starmer has warned Britain still in Lebanon to leave immediately as violence between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. Speaking on board a plane to New York, where he'll attend the annual UN General Assembly, the Prime Minister said the government was ramping up contingency plans. British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations. Here's our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale.
An additional 700 UK military personnel are being flown to Cyprus. Preparations for a potential evacuation of British nationals from Lebanon, if necessary. They'll join another 500 military personnel who are already in Cyprus, sent over the summer amid growing concerns of the deteriorating security situation in the Middle East. The fact that hundreds more are now being flown to Cyprus is a reflection of increasing concerns about the safety of at least 10,000 UK nationals still in Lebanon.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has appeared at the UN Security Council, urging countries to force Russia to end its war with Ukraine. Speaking during the special session in New York, he said the conflict could not be allowed to fade away.
This war can't be calmed by talks. Action is needed. And I'm grateful to all the nations that are truly helping in ways that save the lives of our people. Putin has broken so many international norms and rules that he won't stop on his own. Russia can only be forced into peace.
There's growing unease within the NHS in England about the government's rhetoric that the health service is broken. Senior sources have told the BBC they believe some of the comments and claims have gone too far and could result in lasting damage to patient and staff confidence in the NHS. The revelations come ahead of this morning's speech to the Labour Party conference by the Health Secretary Wes Streeting. Prosecutors in the US have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Routh, who's 58, was already facing two gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this month. Sean Combs, the US rapper, also known as P. Diddy,